And April of last year was a bit of a boiling point. For myself, at least, it was like, I cannot sit here and look at my screen anymore and just intake all of this terrible information. I gotta be able to do something about it. I think if you're someone who grows up with food, if you grow up with security, then you think to yourself that this can't happen to you, or there's a major barrier between you and them. We kind of set out with the mission of, okay, let's just find one farm that can give us one chunk of food and move it to one food bank.
Welcome to Mindful Businesses, presented by Sarani, and I'm your host, Vidya Iyer. In our podcast, we bring to you brands which are mindful in their practices and processes. A mindful business adopts and employs sustainable social, economic, and environmental practices. Today, we have with us Aidan Riley, co-founder of The Farmling Project, Harvesting Hope. Welcome, Aidan.
Thanks for having me.
As we record this episode, the pandemic is still not over and tragically still looms on our heads. It has highlighted so many of the problems that exist in our world, the disparity between incomes, climate change, and food insecurity. But there existed food insecurity even before the pandemic, right? In the United States, what were the food insecurity levels?
Yeah, according to certain reports by Feeding America, who's a leading nonprofit in food insecurity, we're looking at 1 in 6 families in the United States before the pandemic who were food insecure. And food insecure is kind of a whitewashed term for hunger. I mean, it essentially just means you don't know where your next meal is going to come from. And that's was very much a reality for that many people in the U.S.
And how do we compare to the other so-called developed countries?
That's kind of the whole thing that FarmLink is looking at is, you know, the United States being the wealthiest country in the world, you would expect there to be, you know, a land of surplus and opportunity and everyone is fed, a land of like milk and honey, but it's not the case. Mm-hmm. We rank far down the list compared to other developed countries in regards to how many families we have that are dependent on food banks, how many families we have that are dependent on welfare checks. And of course, that was all just only exacerbated when the pandemic hit.
So what do you tell the people who say these are lazy people? That's why they don't have the money. They are not working hard as other people in this country are. And why should we be responsible for their misfortune?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the last year has put that kind of opinion into perspective for many people who held it. And what I mean by that is you saw disaster crisis scenarios, in which case, for example, let's say half of a small town in Maryland, I'm just speaking figuratively, worked for Boeing. And then due to this crisis, Boeing had to lay off 5% of its employees, and many came from that town. Then suddenly people who had even had stable jobs, had families, and had reliability, suddenly do not have any of those things. And that has been the case with so many people that we've spoken to who have depended on food banks. They're not put in that scenario from years of poor decisions necessarily. It can be, in some cases, in extreme cases, an overnight, completely unforeseen event that changes everything for them. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're someone who grows up with food, if you grow up with security, then you think to yourself that this can't happen to you, or there's a major barrier between you and them. And I think everyone should be humbled a little bit to understand that that's not necessarily the case, not even in the United States.
In the pandemic, the kids were affected even more because often many of the meals the kids got in their schools, their breakfast and lunch most likely, got the meals in the school. So now that they were home, it also put an additional burden on the families, which were already fragile.
Absolutely. Completely. You're right. You're completely right. We've talked to so many families who, yeah, they were dependent on their children going to school and getting a lunch of some sorts, food of some sorts for, like you said, breakfast and lunch. And when that goes away and kids at home, let's say you have 4 children and you work a job, even if you're working that job from home, to be able to provide and go to the grocery store and that much more to your own schedule, you know, we're seeing a absolute shortage of time on behalf of parents, and that can lead to a host of issues, but it's absolutely the case. I mean, if you have 4 children and you're working a job, how are you expected to make 12 meals a day? It borders on impossible.
In our collective memory, we have the image of the serpentine cars outside food banks. You know, even as I say this, it's hard because that vision that we saw on TV, on media, on in the newspapers, it's kind of etched, and you're only 21 years old, right? And what you are trying to do, you and your co-founder, James Kanoff, are trying to do is pretty commendable. How did you guys start this?
We started it about a year ago, and it was pretty much just with the effort reading articles about food waste. And specifically, New York Times was doing a major story on farmers having to dump food due to contracts being slashed at the beginning of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So that's farmers who supplied, you know, food to UCLA, which what I live next to, or Brown University, where I go. That's thousands and thousands of meals that were previously accounted for that are no longer accounted for. And they can't pay to store that food, specifically produce and dairy and milk. That refrigeration costs money and they don't have the time to do it. So they're throwing it out. And to juxtapose that with images of, like you said, these serpentine lines of cars going around food banks, which is happening simultaneously, felt extremely, to put it coyly, felt very silly because these felt like two issues that could help solve each other. So that's what we set out trying to do. We kind of set out with the mission of, okay, let's just find one farm that can give us one truck of food and move it to one food bank, which was what we picked, was the one that him and I, James and I, grew up volunteering at in Santa Monica. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we said, we don't know anything about agriculture and we don't know anything about freight and we don't know that much about the rising level of food insecurity right now. I'm pretty sure we're smart enough to figure out how we can get one truck of this surplus food away from the dump and instead to this food bank. And we cold called farms, hundreds of them.
So how did you and James meet?
James and I have known each other since middle school. I moved middle schools and in sixth grade we met. We became really close friends along with my twin brother and a couple other friends. We had a little friend group, and by the time we got to high school, we went to separate high schools, but we started making films together, short little films that we would submit to our high school film festivals. Mm-hmm. And that kind of grew into college when we decided, okay, let's start making documentaries, which is what we were both really interested in, wanting to tell the story of people who lived outside of the bubble that we grew up in Los Angeles. We made two documentaries together throughout college, and that was all put on hold, of course, right at the start of the pandemic.
So you and James put your heads together and said, let's get one farmer on board.
Yeah.
How many phone calls did you have to make to get that one farmer on board? Was it fairly easy? Because, you know, farmers were throwing their produce away and there is this good cause. Two young gentlemen are coming and asking them, was it very easy to get them on board?
It was not very easy. It was difficult, I think, because we didn't even have a name yet. We didn't know anything about them and they didn't know anything about us. And I didn't know anything about their issues. So they're at a time of high stress. The last thing they wanted was some kid calling their phone and saying, hey, let me take your load of potatoes that you're going to send to the dump and we're going to bring it to a food bank. We often had about a minute before we could maybe get hung up on. So we maybe made 150, 200 calls before getting an answer.
That requires a lot of resilience and passion, right?
Yeah.
Because it's easy to get disenchanted.
Yeah, it requires both of those things, but it also requires a lot of time, which is all that we had, you know, last year. I had nothing to do besides sit there and twiddle my thumbs all day. School had been canceled. All of my other projects had been put on hold. And I just couldn't shake the feeling that this was something that could work if we could just get past the answering machine of some of these farmers. So it was a lot of phone calls, but it wasn't a lot of time. We did this over the course of 1 or 2 days. I mean, within 3 days, I think we had our first delivery. So we moved very quickly.
And it was important. The speed and the urgency was an important part because people were starving, people were going hungry, and you were dealing with perishables. So I'm glad you were able to reach somebody very quickly. Do you remember the moment that you picked up and you dropped off at the food bank?
Yeah.
When was that? Do you remember the date?
April 16th. And I do remember the first delivery. It was not that long ago. It was just over a year ago. And I'm never going to forget it because it was an incredibly unique experience. I had to go rent a U-Haul from downtown Los Angeles because we had no other truck or service that would do it, essentially. And the farmer we were speaking to was just outside LA. And he said, I have about 13,000 eggs, but I have no way to get them to you. You can have them if you can get them. And so he rented a U-Haul the night before, drove it on the 405 freeway, loaded up all those eggs in the back, and then drove it to the food bank maybe half an hour, 45 minutes away as they were bouncing around in the back of the truck. And I'd never driven a U-Haul, let alone one with 13,000 eggs in the back. So it was memorable. But more than that, once we dropped them off and delivered and put them in and the food bank said, thank you, and we're going to use these and this is going to be super helpful, it was a proof of concept. It was like, wow, being this persistent, even if we're kind of being dumb about it, which is what we thought we were at the time, it actually might work. Let's try another one.
So did you deliver all these eggs to one food bank or several?
We split it up between two food banks in Santa Monica, West Side Food Bank and then another one.
Often the food banks have food drives, right? And they ask you to put out your cans. And I would actually almost always feel bad to put out a canned goods because you want people to eat fresh food, you know, not just canned, something just canned 2 years ago.
Yeah.
But what you're doing is incredible because often in food banks, people open a bunch of canned soup, and I'm not generalizing, but it is easier because you're working with volunteers to do that sort of a cooking. How did these food banks take now the fresh food that you're giving? Did they have the means to use it?
Yeah, it differs from food bank to food bank. You know, if you do